problem in reversible slack. She wasn't moved, everything stayed the same. Never the first day of school. I thought I could get over. I tried to play safe, but my mom said, no, no way.
A podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me CC, and I'm joined by my partner, organizing Denise.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm caffeinated. Yes.
Okay, everyone beware. Everyone beware. When Denise is caffeinated, a lot of things can happen.
It's my superpower.
Uh-oh. No, I don't think it's a superpower if you have to, like, take something and then, like... I mean, that's like Popeye. Did Popeye have a superpower?
Exactly. Yes. Mm. This is exactly like Popeye.
Okay, I'm going to think on it. There were so many things that were revealed this week. I don't know where to begin. You know, the most shocking to me was that Jada Pinkett Smith said she was a drug dealer. Did you hear? You know, she's doing the rounds right now for the movie coming out, Girls Trip. Haven't decided if I'm going to see it, but... In a radio interview, she said she wanted, you know, of course she was asked because All Eyes on Me came out, and I don't know if you've seen it yet, but obviously there is someone playing Jada in it, and it comes up a lot, and people like to misrepresent the relationship she had with Tupac, and she's like, there's a lot of things that she's not going to reveal about it because they kept it secret because it was between them and they got it, but everyone keeps trying to make this a romantic situation, and that's not what it was. It was about survival. She was coming out of it, and he was going into it.
Why does it surprise you that Jada was a drug dealer?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know that it surprises me per se. I mean, Baltimore is currently going down a very ugly rabbit hole. I think it was more the way she just like dropped it. She was like, you know, I was a drug dealer.
I think this is what. A lot of people don't understand about Blackness in America specifically is that most of us don't have generational wealth. So there's no social safety net. So our survival means whatever is necessary. It could be a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I just saw a documentary on Princess Nokia, and she talks about that. And she's like, when you're on the street, you're never just one thing. You would do a little bit selling this, a little bit of that, do a little bit of that. But when people have to survive, they'll do whatever they need to do to survive.
Sure, I guess. I mean, you know, the juice is loose again. Hey, the juice. OJ.
Oh, God. He ain't loose yet.
Not yet. Loose yet. The earliest.
People get crunk on the thought that he might be loose in the near future. So it's going to be a lot when he's loose. Like, look, I hope OJ's flipping on some Kardashian type, my celebrity make me money type. You know, like.
Hey.
I hope he come out and is everywhere, like Mike Tyson.
He's still like Mike Tyson. Please don't make a cartoon like Mike Tyson. Well, you know, the juice, he's 70 now, so.
Time flies, man.
Time flies. He, you know, he still maintains that he didn't know the people were armed who were helping him get his memorabilia back. It doesn't really matter. His parole has been granted. He will be out. At the earliest on October 1st. And then, you know, there was Tyga again talking about Black China. And, you know, it annoyed me. We're not going to go into it too much. But I was just annoyed because he was like, I tried to tell him what that game was. No, Tyga. You and Black China were inseparable for 3 years. Mm. Inseparable. And then you got dirty on her. So don't talk about what Black China's game is, okay? Okay?
Because Tyga don't even have Cali money, so he needs to check
him out. He doesn't have any money. He rents, and he can barely buy the press.
And I'm so glad that little girl, you know, for all the ain't shit her sisters might be, they hipped into some birth control. Goddamn. Because she didn't get trapped in that game. She was like, Tyga come, Tyga go.
No, but dudes are living off of Black China and then wanting to call her out. Like Ferrari, who's in negotiations with Love and Hip Hop Atlanta? The only reason he's in negotiations with Love and Hip Hop Atlanta is because he was Black China's side piece and was pictured in those revealing photos that Rob decided to post on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Everything about Ferrari's story comes from Black China. He is only relevant because of Black China. So these dudes, they need to stop talking, for real.
And who knows what even happened, right? Like, she could have just, like, had him by for, like, a game of Connect Four, and he just, like, slipped up in, like, I gotta use the bathroom, and then next thing you know, he is Instagramming.
What other big news that we have this week? I tell you this, everyone's making jokes about it on Instagram. Usher! Oh. Usher, why you giving a bridesmaid from your wife, your ex-wife's bridal shower party, whatever? Herpes? Usher, you had to you had to settle, what was it, $1 million?
$1.1 million. Don't forget the point one. So I called in text with my friend, I called Usher an STD stealther, because there's this new kind of form of rape that they wanted to specify, which is called stealthing. And stealthing is this idea that some, you know, people will consent to sex, but sex with a condom, and that unbeknownst to the to one party, the party with the condom will take off the condom at some point without informing anybody or getting consent. So this is rape, right? Because it's not consented to. So in my opinion, Usher, I'm gonna try to coin this, is an STD stealther, because we've been trying to figure out, like, what to call this for a long time. Now, in California, STD stealthing, if it results in infection of another party, okay? And sometimes even if it results in just exposure to another party, is a criminal offense. And this is a really twisted subject, because HIV advocates, have been against this kind of legislation for a long time, because remember, Mr. Mandingo ended up in prison over this, right?
Wow. Yes, he did.
So what HIV advocates have been saying is that, you know, in the vast majority of cases where STDs, STIs are transmitted, we, you know, a lot of times there's, you don't know who infected you, right?
Right.
And so to be able to single out who infected you and then to single them out for prosecution then says, okay, well, we are not, you know, takes the responsibility away from people to actually just use safer sex practices. Mm-hmm. Instead, you know, people are required not only to know their status, but inform the other party of their status. Now, this case with Usher is a little bit different, because the woman asked him outright, so did you get that STI test? And he was like, absolutely, everything negative. So he not only knew his status, but then he, like, lied about his status. So it's not like Usher was just, like, living his life, had herpes, right? Had herpes. As many people live their life and have herpes.
Right. Plenty of people have herpes. It's probably the most common. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? But Usher knew, mm-hmm, had the herpes, and then lied about it willfully so he could continue having unprotected sex with someone under the guise that he was completely negative.
Right.
It's a problem. It was a problem. So then that starts to look like the situation in upstate New York, where a man, like, willfully sought out people to infect, right?
Right.
So, yeah, that's why she got that 1.1, because, hey, you know, he had all the people.
Anyway,
I might have pushed for more.
I would have pushed for enough that I can remain a millionaire after paying my taxes. That's what I would have pushed for.
Because 1.1 ain't one.
That's going to ease you. That's going to ease you back into the mine. You're not in the millionaire range anymore. You need to go higher. Mm-hmm. So you stay millionaire range.
You hood rich on that. You're not rich. You're not wealthy.
You're not wealthy.
You hood rich.
You could invest and perhaps become wealthy. But
you
good
can
on
her. TJ Walker it.
Right, right.
You could do that.
But good on her, good on her. So I know all of our listeners are like, okay, we heard all that. Get to it. Yes, we're going to get to it. What was I wouldn't call it a bombshell. I would call it, again, the news that came out that, you know, had the internet shook, if you will, was the report by Jim DeRogatis, who has been on the scene for a very long time when it comes to R. Kelly reporting.
Jim don't let up. Wait. He broke it?
He broke it.
Because Jim don't never let up. Because I was like, you know what? I know Jim is going to chime in. Nope. But I didn't, because everybody, it had like this kind of like explosive thing where everybody was reporting on it at the same time.
It was Jim.
So I wasn't aware he broke it.
Yes. Jim's article on BuzzFeed.
Jim, the kind of investigative reporter we need in these times. Like, I think
he's actually a music journalist.
Yeah.
But when it comes to R. Kelly, he shows the breadth of his talent.
He harnessed all his petty into this story.
Look, I needed, and I will say I'm not a super fast reader, but I needed 25 minutes. And you know me, you send me stuff, and if it takes me more than 5 minutes, I'm done. I needed 25 minutes to read this article titled, R. Kelly is holding women against their will in a cult, parents told police. Okay? I'm not going to go into all the details because there are so many. But the short and long of it is that he has talked to some parents who say that R. Kelly is holding their women, not against their will. It is technically consensual, but these women were young when R. Kelly met them. They're barely of legal age. Doesn't matter. Barely's not a thing in law terms. They are of legal age. And R. Kelly confiscates their phones, gives them new ones, dictates to them what they wear, when they sleep, what they eat, how they engage with him and his other friends. He, you know, uses them as his sex playthings and so on and so forth. And the parents are trying diligently to get their daughters back. But the law says there's nothing we can really do because it's consensual adults. Now, for those of you who don't know who Jim is, Jim has been on the scene for a minute. He's also the person who received anonymously the infamous sex tape where R. Kelly allegedly had sex with someone on the tape who at the time must have been 14 years old. I will say I never watched that tape. Never watched it. I know a lot of people did. I never watched it. It was enough for me to really watch the Chappelle skit, Boondocks. I got the gist of it. On that tape, he's allegedly, you know, pees on a 14-year-old girl. He was acquitted for that. Jim also was the one who broke the news of a lawsuit in 1996 when Tiffany Hawkins sued R. Kelly, claiming that they had sex when she was 15 years old. So, you know, he's been around for a minute. I believe, if I'm not incorrect, he was the one who obtained documents concerning the whole Aaliyah thing and the annulment of the marriage. So, you know, Jim is, he's all about some due diligence when it comes to R. Kelly. But I need to hear from you, Denise.
Oh, no, not me. Oh, my gosh.
Explain to those of us who may not understand. So for those of you who may not know, R. Kelly is only into Black women. So all of these young women are Black.
And this is why he gets away with it.
Okay. So that's where we need Denise to decode for us what we need to understand about the significance of these events.
I will start with when old boy was interviewing the journalist, not the same journalist, but Toussaint. I forgot his first name. When he was interviewing R. Kelly, the infamous clip where he says, are you into teenagers? And R. Kelly responded with, when you say teenagers, how old are you talking? That was the response of this grown-ass 30-something-year-old man at the time. Okay. Grown. Okay. So, and then I'll say, nothing magic happens when you turn 18. You turn 18, it's not like all of a sudden people pull you aside and say, hey, now this is what power dynamics look like. Actually, biologically, our brains don't start developing until we're in our early 20s. So you still have the same kind of adolescent things going on at 18 that you would have at 17 or 16, okay? You still have the same adolescent types of behaviors. You don't just sort of like grow the hell up at 18, right? So if you have like a predator waiting in the wings until you turn 18, because he realized that if, you know, he does this to a 14-year-old, like that's a whole nother case.
Well, he learned that, right?
He learned that. right? He had to go through a whole media circus, and he had to go through a case, and he had to get lawyers, and he had to pay a little bit of money. So because he learned that, now he's just watching and waiting in the wings until these girls turn exactly 18. Okay. And then you have to look at the dynamics of power and how fame pushes into that. He has a certain amount of cult fame, especially in the Black community. He's like an R&B god. And so he comes into these communities with so much credibility. I think that there hasn't been a community of turning their back on him is just about the ways in which we've been so scarred by stereotypes about Black men and how that has been used to persecute them and persecute us. We've been so scarred by the legacy of this over-sexualization of Black men, and that we are so wary about what we hear and reluctant to even trust it. But what I see even more than this reluctance to trust what people hear about R. Kelly is that people sort of know it, but they're like, but it's on this side of the law. So all of a sudden, when it comes to a Bill Cosby or when it comes to a R. Kelly, people become, they have a ton of faith in the law. They believe all of a sudden that the law is just. They don't believe that the law is just when Zimmerman gets off in front of a court of his peers, right? Like in front of a jury of his peers. They don't believe that. They understand that the law isn't just, right? Mm-hmm. When Trayvon Martin is killed and no one goes to jail. Mm-hmm. No one even spends a day in jail, right? They don't believe that the law is just when, you know, the person who comes into a church and kills Black people is then allowed to get Burger King on his way to jail, right? And isn't even in cuffs, right? Like, so they understand that the law isn't just in those cases when it has to do with the deaths of Black people, but they all of a sudden, when it has to do with the rape of Black women and girls, they think that the law is absolutely infallible.
Is that what it is? Or is that just kind of the cognitive dissonance
It's cognitive dissonance, of course, right? But it's this inconsistency in beliefs depending on where you land within the power dynamic. Right. I think Black women are really clear by and large. The Black women that I know are really clear by and large that R. Kelly is a predator. I think that people just really.
Yeah, but that's not the case. Right. Because we're talking about parents here. So one of the parents had been in her interview with Jim said that she, you know, she remembered the trial, but he was acquitted. So why should she, you know, think that that has anything to do with him? Why wasn't anyone telling her that he is this person beforehand? Those were her words. It was.
I think that's the problem, right? Like, you know, this level of taking this kind of risk with your child, that happens within families too, right? Your cousin tells you that the uncle molested her and abused her, but that never went to court. She never told the police. And, you know, she seems kind of messed up anyway. And sometimes you saw her lying about something else. Back in the day about something else. And so you're not really sure. But really what is more than all of that is this complete desire, this almost like willful stubbornness that wants Black women and men to believe in the goodness of our Black men, especially when they are succumbing to the most horrible stereotypes that have been placed upon them. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there is this like Zora Neale Hurston short story where she talks about a Black family that is just, you know, people would go by their house and then give them money. And the man had the father had a hand that was cut off, and the daughter had been pregnant as a teenager and had a child. And the story that these white people had about this Black family was that the husband was a drunk and a ne'er-do-well, and he came home one night, and then the mother and the daughter used to sleep together, and instead of having sex with his wife, he forced himself on his daughter. The wife woke up, realized what was happening, and chopped off his hand. The daughter became pregnant with her father's child. Now, that's not what happened at all. Like, the father, like, hurt his hand in an accident. The kid had a child from somebody else. Like, that's not the pathology that they were living with. But they took these white people's money because they knew that was the only story that they would believe. Mm-hmm. And that would make them feel good. That would make them feel good so much that they would give money to witness the pathology in action. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, they were, like, rolling by this farm just to see these people, like, haul water and, like, feed their animals, just to witness it.
Okay,
so that's how powerful Black pathology is in the mainstream imagination. And we know that. And so we try to protect our, we try to protect Black men from that. We try to protect, we try to ignore signs that hit even to anything that looks like that pathology.
Well, surely at the very latest, after R. Kelly himself revealed that he was abused as a child, he was instructed to watch and photograph adults having sex, he was raped repeatedly for years by an older woman, and he was possibly even abused by a man. And a lot of that is what he is said to be doing to women now. But my question is, if they're consenting adults, okay, yeah, sure. There are plenty of people who, you know, think they're grown at 18 or 17, whatever the, you know, every state has a different legal year, 16, 17, 18. Sure, they're not necessarily grown, right? But they're under the law allowed to make their own decisions. We all were teen bad decisions at that age, slept with people we maybe shouldn't have been sleeping with, did things we maybe shouldn't have done, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the big deal? Why is this a problem? One of the women, Joycelyn Savage, took to the camera twice to say that she's fine. She said, you know, she didn't get crunk or anything. She just said, "Dad, I love you, but this has got to stop. Stop, stop, stop. I am okay. I am here on my own. I'm here where I want to be. Please stop."
It's the level of isolation.
Yeah, at some point, though, that also has to be respected. Even if you think that, you know, there's no way that she can be happy there, you can't make that decision for her. She has to go through this now. You've done your best. She's an adult who's decided to stay there.
Actually, a lot of people have pointed out that this whole story just doesn't understand the full extent of brainwashing, you know, and we are.
But that's
are
something
very
that's cool. being assumed right now.
Yeah, but this woman has never like it would be one thing if this woman was moving independently in the world. She is not. OK, so this is not someone who is allowed to actually be outside on her own going to the gym. This is not someone who is allowed, it seems, to like just like live her life. And then on her way from the Starbucks, she's saying, "Hey, by the way, I'm fine." Right. So because she doesn't have freedom of movement, which is
she was outside
a human
on
right,
the second video.
You know what I'm talking about. Freedom of movement. because she doesn't have this level of freedom of movement, mm-hmm. it cannot be clear
mm-hmm.
that actually what she is saying is of her own free will. I mean, if the cops were going to actually really investigate this situation, they would even in situations of incest, right? They have to take the victim away from the family for a while
mm-hmm.
to start to get to some answers.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I think that people don't really fully psychologically understand how sex abuse works in the psychology of the victim.
Okay, but if you're going down that route, and I don't mean mm-hmm. to interrupt you, but if you're mm-hmm. going down that route, what's the difference between, you know, this situation and other couples who have signed agreements of their sub-dom power dynamic? There are people who live that out every day, right? You have to address me a certain way. You have to wear a leash. You have to wear a muzzle. You're not allowed to look at me in the eyes. I can have sex with you at any given moment, wherever I please. There are consenting adults who have these types of relationships, and in those situations it's simply called kink. What's the difference?
Right. I think what you don't understand about kink is that kink is
what I don't understand.
What people may not understand about kink. Ooh. People telling on themselves. What people may not understand about kink is that kink actually nurtures and encourages a consistent, ongoing consent. Not this kind of like, you've consented to this like last week, and now whatever happened, happens, right? You've consented to this, and now it's bled into every single part of your life. Like, kink relationships that are healthy actually have conditions, right? And they have an ongoing process by where someone of free will, and free will is very important, can consent, right? And that there is an acknowledgement of a power dynamic that turns you on, but then there's also an acknowledgement of a power dynamic that it exists between the two people that are doing the kink, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just say, okay, I'm doing kink with, you know, someone who's not of the age of consent. I'm doing kink with someone who is vulnerable to me because if they say no, they are homeless. I'm doing kink with someone who knows if they say no to me, they have repercussions that are above and beyond. Period. If you say no, and there are to any kind of consensual, to any kind of kink, let's say, and there are repercussions, then that's not kink. That's something else.
In our second segment, I have the pleasure of being in conversation today with Raquel Willis. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. We've been trying to make this happen for a little bit.
Yes, we have. And I'm very excited that it's happening today. For our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So my name is Raquel Willis. I'm a writer and activist. And I also like to think of myself as a media maven. You might see that online.
Yes.
you know, the funny thing is I, over the last few years, have taken a liking to social media. I think it's a very powerful tool to discuss experiences, particularly for marginalized people, right? People with marginalized identities. As a Black trans woman, I I just try and live out loud and be my full self in the way that I feel like everyone should be able to. But also because it took me years to kind of get to a point where I could speak my truth. So yeah, so that's me off of, you know, my 9-to-5. But I actually also am a national organizer at the Transgender Law Center. And so a lot of that work is based in elevating and training transgender leaders to really be in the best service to their communities. And so we very much believe that you can't just come in and tell people what they need and what they want. You have to, you know, listen actually is one of the biggest tools that we use is listening and helping people assess what they need, mm-hmm. right? And assess what they need in specific communities. And so this past weekend, I was actually in Fort Lauderdale and it was a good experience. And it was nice to, you know, see another trans community in another city. Just, I think a lot of us become so disconnected, but a lot of us are actually trying to organize around some very similar things.
And what would you say, because even in your 9-to-5, so to speak, there's activism work that you're doing on top of what you do in your personal time. What would you say are what is your vision for activism in 2017-18? What is important to you?
Right. So that's a big question because I think the climate has changed so much in just a year's time, right? So we're seeing a lot of reactive work happening in reaction to the Trump administration and everything that's kind of happening politically. It's all over the place, a hot mess. And so I actually really want us to get to thinking broader, right? Like thinking about a long-lasting vision of liberation, one in which it won't be so easy to kind of roll back the quick fixes that we've had mm-hmm. in terms of equality, right? Like I think, you know, thinking about things like protections for trans students, thinking about things like, you know, the passage of marriage equality, particularly in the queer lens. Those things were great, but in many ways, they were just band-aids over much larger issues, right? There's a lot of cultural shift that still needs to happen to make sure that we are protected, you know? So we're still seeing trans people being used as scapegoats for incompetent politicians who have no other agenda, right?
Right.
Because their agenda isn't to, particularly on the conservative side or on the right, is not to build anything new or change anything. It's to maintain the status quo. It's to conserve their power.
Exactly.
Right. And that's not to say that, you know, liberals are off the hook or that the Democratic Party is off the hook, because in many ways, very similar strategies are used at the top, right, in terms of conserving, consolidating power and not actually listening to the most marginalized that they claim to represent, you know?
Yes.
So that's where we are, right? I'm interested in pushing us to see a bigger vision of liberation, but also continuing to elevate the voices of Black trans folks, Black trans women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I intentionally center Black trans women because I think there's a lot that can be learned from our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And not really even talking about myself, right? Because I feel like I've had a lot of privilege over the years to accomplish things and be safer than some of my sisters, but really learning from my other sisters, right? The sisters who are struggling day in and day out to keep a job, the ones who are struggling to find access to healthcare, the ones who are, you know, doing sex work to survive.
Mm-hmm.
These are the ones that I want their stories to really be elevated.
How can we do a better job of elevating those stories?
Well, you know, I think that it's difficult to give a streamlined answer.
Sure.
I think that everyone has a different calling in life and approach. And I think that you can be a good advocate for a trans person, you know, even if you're working in fast food or in the service industry, right? Like, it's about respecting people who are different from you, but also recognizing when things are going down, right? When somebody is yelling at, you know, a Black trans woman, oh, that's a man or something like that. Your job, especially as a cisgender person, is not to, you know, for lack of better terminology, sit on your ass and just let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
But your job is to actually, like, show up and advocate for them in that time, right? It's to seek out information instead of making posts on social media saying that you don't actually have an opinion, but you actually do, and it's a very wrong and uninformed one,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's about, you know, if we're going to actually have a conversation about trans people, then actually dialogue with trans people,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's one thing I continuously see on social media is people bringing us up as debate topics or as hypotheticals, right? Like, what if you came home and your kid was doing so-and-so? No, don't do that. That's petty. That's not actually something that anybody should be doing, right? If you want to know more about trans people or you're confused about something, then, you know, do some reading, do some Googling, seek out people like me and many others online who regularly tell their experiences and their stories, you know, and I think it's as simple as people actually like being on the up and up, right? Like, I would actually have more respect for you if you were just, you know, upfront about your transphobia, because then I know what I can work on instead of going back and forth mm-hmm. on where you actually stand.
I'd like to ask you something about the word transphobic specifically. It comes up mm-hmm. often, and I wonder if, and I say this about many words that we use in when it comes to phobias and isms, and I do try to avoid being too academic about it, which I know I can be. But I wonder sometimes if the word transphobic or transphobia is overused and silences people who might be trying to have genuine conversations. For example, obviously read your thread when Chimamanda made her remarks, and without wanting to go into her remarks, because we've done that on the show and I think they've been thoroughly discussed across social media. But when cisgender women, for example, want to talk about their specific experiences as we're as we're seeing in the U.S., where access to reproductive health, access to sexual health, resources for abortion and so forth are on the table and being taken off the table and being revoked. Often that does lead to a statement of, you know, it's transphobic to talk about that as a cisgender woman. And I'm wondering, how can we have these within the community, especially, right, within the queer community? I'm not even talking about people who have no connection, no familiarity, but within the queer community, how can we have those conversations without it spiraling into calling out, silencing, and then no one being able to actually listen to each other?
Right. Well, one thing for me with the Chimamanda situation was I actually took space to process my various emotions about what she was saying. Much of it was anger and disappointment. I think one of the things about it is more people need to take space to figure out what they're about to say. And the problem with social media in particular, which is where we often see call-out culture just kind of play out messily and sloppily, is that people, it's like literally your brain is connected to the internet and people don't actually like take those few seconds to think about what's coming through their fingers. So, you know, when it comes to call out culture, I think people just need to be more intentional about what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And let's just process, right? Because every time we see a difficult topic on the internet, we're actually like experiencing a little bit of trauma at that moment. And I think particularly when we're talking about transphobia, there's such a lack of knowledge about what that means, right? There's such a lack of knowledge just in general about trans people and how to discuss our experiences and our identities. And that's something that we can acknowledge, right?
Right.
Without coddling people or allowing foolishness to go unchecked.
Absolutely.
As my dad would say. My Black Southern daddy. So I think when I hear cis people complaining about the overuse of transphobia, mm-hmm. I hear white people complaining about the overuse of racism. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, yeah. All of these things that you've been able to just do your entire life and never think twice about, when you finally start getting called out on it and regularly, and I'm saying called out not in an aggressive way or a negative
right.
way, but just being held accountable to them. Yeah, it's gonna seem like you're being attacked. It's gonna seem like people are nitpicking, right? Mm-hmm. But the point is that you should be able to put yourself in the other person's shoes, right? So what is it for you to change language about an experience that's not actually yours, right? That's actual respect, mm-hmm. you know? So like for me, there are experiences that I have to continue to grow and learn about, particularly thinking about my disabled, you know, fam and siblings and brothers and sisters. I am constantly having to check my, you know, able privilege mm-hmm. and what it means to really respect people, right? And come to an understanding about what it means to respect people, even if you don't exactly know, you know, what their experience is like. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of work, right? And especially as an activist, especially as a feminist, especially as someone who works day in and day out to make sure that marginalized people are taken care of. Yeah, it's a lot of work for me, but I'm committed to that work. And I think we all should be committed to doing that work. Mm-hmm. So there's that. The other thing I will say is that even the ways we talk about gender show how limited even cis people are when it comes to gender norms, right? So particularly when I encounter cis women who talk about trans women taking over their spaces or taking over their dialogue or narrative, I understand where that is coming from. Mm-hmm. Because it is true that men do that, right? And it is true that for up until this generation, right, cis women didn't really have to share space with trans women, right? Mm-hmm. This just is a completely different time that we're living in. And so I understand the feelings of feeling like something is being taken away from you. But nothing is really, right? Because when I talk about healthcare and I talk about trans healthcare, I'm very clear about what I mean when I say that, right? I mean trans women who have all types of different bodies, et cetera, et cetera. When you're talking about women's healthcare, trans women are women, mm-hmm. right? And so to you know, shift our understanding that a vagina doesn't necessarily make a woman, right? And that there are women who don't have the exact same relationship to their body, even cis women who don't have the exact same relationship to their body, cis women who don't have like uteruses that right. are typically functioning, or uteruses, period. Mm-hmm. That is not taking anything away from you, because the fact of the matter is you've been erasing cis women with different bodily experiences the entire time too, mm-hmm. right? So it's not even just trans women. And then it's also that not every trans woman has the same body, right? Right. So when you assume that you making a quip about their penises being in a certain space, you actually don't know anything about what you're talking about, because there are plenty of trans women who don't have penises, right? Right. And it's so reductive for us to have conversations that tie penises to the patriarchy, right? Or tie vaginas to, I don't know what, you know.
Yeah.
That really tie these body parts to our identities like that, mm-hmm. right? And that's not to say that we shouldn't discuss periods, or we shouldn't discuss abortions, et cetera, but I know trans men and trans masculine people who also have those experiences, right? So what does that mean for them? Mm-hmm. So it's really just about us knowing our audiences, seeing people for who they are and respecting them for who they are. And that shouldn't take anything away from you, you know? And it's complex.
It's very too. Complex, yeah.
I think it's a lot deeper than, all of this is a lot deeper than what putting on a pink pussy hat and saying that represents womanhood. It's a lot deeper than that.
It is a lot deeper than that. I mean, I can find that personally quite frustrating in certain scenarios and situations as a cis woman who does not identify as femme to be in a space with someone who it does not identify as trans, is designated male at birth, and identifies as non-binary or chooses a femme identity and puts on makeup and says that's what makes them or that's, you know, what makes them a woman. And that can feel to me like, wait a minute. Also, we have to, in the queer community, we can't let our identities be surface level identities. We are leading this conversation about, you know, expansiveness and what it means to be a human being and however that human being identifies. And if we limit our characteristics of identity to things like wearing makeup or not wearing makeup, putting on lipstick or not putting on lipstick, shaving armpits or not, because I don't do any of those things, then...
That's true. I see you.
Then I think, you know, we have to also assess, if we're going to lead this conversation, then we have to get real with our own areas of, I don't even want to call it internalized oppression. Just, you know, not all of it is internalized oppression. A lot of it is socialization. It's things that we're used to. It's things that we've come to know to represent something. We do it not only in the queer community, right? We do it in the Black community. This is Black. This isn't. Who's invited to the cookout? Who's not? And just recently on the show, we talked about an article about Black pride. And it said specifically, don't bring your white partner or white friend or any white anything to Black Pride. And my partner organizing, Denise, kind of decoded that from her understanding, because she agrees with it. And I'm wondering, with Trans Pride coming up, a big Trans Pride celebration in Brighton, which is in the south of the UK, coming up. Yeah. And I've been invited to attend. So I'm wondering, you know, do we need similar policies for Trans Pride? Are people who don't identify as gender variant, gender non-conforming trans, should they not attend Trans Pride? Obviously, if they do attend, they need to respect certain boundaries. But what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think a better way to frame it is that, you know, my understanding of Black Pride is that Black folks are prioritized and centered.
Right.
Right. It is created as a space to elevate Black folks, hopefully without the white gaze being so present. same thing goes for trans pride to me. You know, it prioritizes trans and gender nonconforming people, right? We often include GNC folks in those spaces as well. But I mean, it's a space to exist and be fully recognized. When you think about typical prides and regular prides, they render so many folks invisible, yes. Right? They invisibilize trans people, even gender nonconforming people, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly people of color, mm-hmm. Black folks, women mm-hmm. of all types. It very much is usually a cis white, not even queer, a cis white gay space.
Absolutely.
And so that's why these spaces are carved out. And I understand, right? Like, I get the arguments from some folks that are like, well, I want to bring my cis partner and friends, I'll feel more comfortable. Well, I want to bring my white partner and friends to Black Pride, I'll feel more comfortable, whatever. But I think, first of all, I'm not going to tell anybody what they can do. They can do whatever they want to do. You hopefully are a grown person making your own decision. But I think in many ways, it is just a little reckless to not consider why that space is being created, right? Mm-hmm. And why for many folks, even if you don't usually have a problem with the white gaze or the cis gaze, why for many folks that space needs to be specific to the community it's supposed to represent. Now, do I think that a few white people here, there are a few cis people here, there is a problem? No. But again, like you just have to be respectful of the customs and that space, right? And the reason why it was even created in the first place. The other thing I will say is that I think anti-Blackness is looked at and taken more seriously than transphobia and transmisogyny mm-hmm. in many spaces. And so I actually don't think that trans pride in particular would be seen as off limits to cis people in the same way that Black pride would be seen as off limits to white folks.
Though I will say UK Black pride, there are definitely a lot of exceptions. A lot of people, it also has to do with the fact that it takes place in a very large park and it shares the space with like the last bit of regular pride. So regular pride takes place on a Saturday. Oh. Black pride takes place on a Sunday, but it's like the last little thing they do in this. It's big enough to separate it, but you know, people wander wow. over and they're like, oh yeah, let's be a part of this. And the first year I went, I was like, oh, look at this. This is so different than, for example, in Berlin, because anything in certain spaces in Germany that is specifically Black, that's who shows up for many reasons, not necessarily positive reasons, not necessarily the right reasons. Mm-hmm. So my first year I was like, oh, this could be cool, right? That other people come in, but then you start thinking about dynamics and how people use yeah. the space, and then you have to really think twice about it. So just to end our conversation, is there anything that you would like to leave us with, things to think about, things to consider, things to be happy and find joy in?
Sure. We talked about a lot in such a short amount of time. And I, you know, I think the thing about particularly the conversation around cis folks with the way we talk about our experiences and why, you know, no one wants to feel like anyone else is taking their narrative and running away with it with the wrong idea. That's just a universal experience. And trans people are no different. We are the masters of our own destiny. And it's very important that, yes, we acknowledge what makes our experiences unique and different. But we also acknowledge what brings us all together. And when I think about the glimpse of the future that trans people give, that non-binary folks give, gender nonconforming folks give, is a future where we're not all so limited by these titles and identities and experiences, right? Because the way that gender norms limit trans people, they also limit cis people. You know, they limit the little boy who's told he can't cry and be emotional. They limit the little girl who's told that, you know, she can't be assertive and push for what she believes in and be sporty. And so it's just very important that we all come to an understanding that our liberation is connected.
Well, thank you so much, Raquel, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This is great. Your podcast is amazing. It's great to hear. And particularly because you know you're in the UK, but to hear the Black queer perspective, even from the UK, right? Because I think that we're so disconnected sometimes from each other's experiences in different countries and cities and stuff. So it's so cool that you have a space and we can dialogue together.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
In our final segment, what are we excited about? What are we looking forward to?
Well, I'm over here dealing with all these Brazilians up in Vienna, so that's lovely. And so tonight, they've already had a workshop about the uses of how resistance is embedded in music and in culture for people throughout the African diaspora, and that was amazing. And then tonight, they will be having a Coco, which is a musical sort of celebration and ceremony. And so I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to continuing to go to these events at the Impulse Dance Festival to, you know, a little turn up, a little something. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm really sad to be missing you and Afropunk.
What am I excited about? Did you say?
No. Oh. Don't be rubbing it in. Don't be rubbing it in.
Okay, it's really hard. I'm absolutely excited to have been invited to experience Trans Pride in Brighton this weekend for the first time. I've never gone. Mm. The seaside is not doing us right, though. We're not going to have great weather. But hey, it is what it is. It is what it is.
Now, is Trans this the first Pride. Time that they're having Trans Pride?
No, it's not the first time they're having. It's the first time I've been invited to go.
Okay.
So I'm excited, and then I will get back on the train for Afropunk London! Yay! And all of my playlists will be there. The internet will be there. Saul Williams will be there. Thundercat will be there. Corinne Bailey Ray will be there. Leanne LaHavis will be there. All kinds of people. And after seeing the pictures from Afropunk Paris from last week, I can only say, I'm ready to party. So that's me.
Take all the snaps for me. Take all the Instagrams.
Well, believe Periscope. I will be on Instagram Live. I will be Periscoping. I will be taking pictures. Follow us. That's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter @TheQueerTruth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today.